I'm at the huge outdoor swimming pool on the campus of the University of California, Berkeley, which is just outside San Francisco, and wandering around the deck here, a telltale sign that this is no ordinary swimming pool comes in the form of the plaques right in front of me on the wall. And these are representing the former students here who have made it to the Olympics. And it goes back all the way to, just straining to look at the top, 1920 with a silver medal, and looking right across the plaques, gold and bronze medal winners as well. You can only imagine the students training in the pool right now have set their sights on one day having their name up on the side of this pool. I'm Peter Bowes, and welcome to the latest programme in our series, The Managers, from the BBC World Service, where we probe six of the most successful and driven coaches to try to find out how they've reached the pinnacle of their sport. I've come here to meet Terry McKeever, the coach of the university swimming team, the UCal Bears, for the past 20 years, who is not only one of the most successful coaches in the world, she's also one of the most innovative. Now, if I was to say that her idea of swimming training is yoga, skipping, or dancing to hip-hop music, then you can get some idea of her methods. And it was those methods which led her to become the coach of the 2012 US Olympic women's team, which won 14 medals. University sport here is the home of the elite. Swimmers based here are the best in the world and combine their training with other classes. Sporting success means as much to American universities as academic excellence.
Say, pick it up now here. It's good.
Well, they're taking a break in training now, and Terry and I are going to take the opportunity to head up to her office, where I hope to find out much more about her coaching journey. Terry, as we move inside, the first thing that strikes me in here is that this is very definitely the office of an Olympic trainer.
Yeah, I'm a very visual person, and I think the workspace is really important, and surround myself with things that I'm proud of, things that make me happy.
I see the poster there from Athens 2004.
Yep, Athens. It's kind of sad that I don't have the London poster up yet, but I do have it. It's just not up yet.
We'll talk a little bit more about London later in the interview. We've just been watching you at work. This is a great complex, and I sense the energy already.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing to be in a university setting. You have the energy of a large campus with 35,000 plus students, and just excellence everywhere. Excellence in the playing fields, classrooms, cafes, and it's a fabulous place to work.
We will talk also about the science behind your coaching methods, but I'd like to start by going back to your childhood, mm-hmm. perhaps where some of those methods started to percolate. Your father was an American sports hero.
Yeah, he was a football player at the University of Southern California with my uncle. They were all Americans, very prominent in their day. Unfortunately, my father had some injuries his senior year in college and wasn't medically approved to play professionally, but my uncle played professionally in the NFL for 13 seasons. And my father was in an automobile accident at 25, hit by a drunk driver, and then subsequently in a coma for 22 months before passing. So, you know, my memories of him are more of stories and other people's interactions more than ever really being able to recall it myself. I was 4 when he was in the accident and about 6 when he passed away. He was an identical twin. So it was always, wasn't real close to my uncle until probably maybe 15 years ago or, you know, off and on kind of growing up. But it was always strange because you could see what your father would look like and you could see yourself in your father. But yet, you know, 99.9% of my memories of my father are stories that either my uncle or my mom or I would meet people and they would tell me stories, you know, even to this day. So it's bittersweet in that regard.
And overnight, your life will have changed dramatically.
Yeah, absolutely. My mom said, you know, Terry, I need you to help me now. Apparently, I wasn't the most giving. I was more of a little, like 4 year olds can be, kind of just doing my own thing. And she said, Terry, I need you to help me. You know, I had two younger brothers with McKeever's, and then my mom got remarried right at eight, when I was about eight, to my dad, Gary Gannon. Now I call him my dad. My seven more children, Gannons. It's one, you know, McKeever Gannons are a big family. Sports has been huge. Seven of my 10 siblings have gone to university on a college scholarship. Everybody found their calling.
And you paint a picture of what must have been quite a frantic lifestyle. Here you are with your mother trying to help bring up your brothers and sisters while developing yourself in sport. What was it like?
Some of the best things about my mother being my coach, actually, is when we would go to national meets, my mom would come as my coach, and it was the only time I ever got to spend alone time with my mom, you know. And we would go to swim meets and pack up all the younger kids, and they played softball growing up, and I would have to work in the snack bar to help everybody. My mom would, and dad would coach their softball teams and their soccer teams, and so it was definitely a all around sports. And then the day I turned 16, I got my driver's license and a credit card and took my siblings shopping, and we'd come home and they'd model, and my mom would say, I don't know if I like that. And I said, no, you don't understand. This is what is in fashion and this is what's appropriate, you know? So.
Well, you were quite the unconventional family, weren't you? And a family very focused around sports with some quite extraordinary facilities at your own home.
My dad is a self-employed contractor. We lived on 11 acres with an amazing home, this huge hallway that we would have races down, and a tennis court, and we had a 25-yard pool that we trained in. And then when I was in high school, it took us a month. We cut down some orange trees and built a two-lane 50-meter pool. Got to stay home from school and help put the tile in and everything. And
this is an Olympic-sized pool.
This is an Olympic-sized
in a
backyard and actually side yard to be specific. And we had a tennis court, a softball field, and we went as far as building a little field hockey net. Very non-traditional, hard to describe.
But it's also, it's almost as if you were destined to become the coach that you are now with that background.
Yeah, I think that, in a lot of ways, I think you're right. You know, I don't think I saw it at the time or really thought about it at the time. But when I sit here in hindsight, I'm like, this is what I was supposed to, like, I am so confident that this is what I was supposed to do. Yeah. I am by nature a very quiet, shy, introverted person, and sports was really the first place where I felt confident and comfortable with being good at something, you know, and having other people notice that I was good at something besides my family, and that it was okay to excel and be proud of that. I think that's why I'm so passionate about how sports is an important vehicle to develop not just your athletics, but your personality and who you are as a person.
And you mentioned you had a pool in your back garden. When did you first realize that you were actually quite good at this sport?
Well, I started swimming competitively at 10, and by 12, I had made our USA Nationals. And I think when I started going to national meets and realizing that I was the youngest of a lot of people there, or the people that you saw in the magazines, I was like, man, I must be pretty good at this. And it just gave me, a sense of confidence and a sense of, you know, walking a little bit taller and being a lot more proud of who I was. And then being able, I think, to take that to school and feel more confident to speak up in class, or where I know early on that was not who I was.
Perfect. Just real quick, how did the swim with Mike go?
I was really low key.
Yeah, was really chill.
And you told us that your mother was extremely supportive. Do you, as you're coaching today, do you feel your mother's presence in your methods and your tactics and your philosophy?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know why I'm getting emotional, but yeah, definitely.
As an introverted, as you've described yourself, young girl, is this something, this character trait, is it something that you see in young girls wanting to enter swimming? Does it attract a certain personality? Because ultimately you're dealing with teams and you train as a team, but it's a very individual discipline, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. The thing I love most about the situation of coaching in a university setting is that you take an individual sport, and I think there is a certain personality type, not so much introvert or extrovert, but an individual that likes to, you know, we don't need someone to pass us a ball to be successful or to rely on a plan, that if we take care of our issues in and outside of the pool, we give ourselves the greatest chance to succeed. And in this setting, it's also about taking care of your personal responsibilities, but it's recognizing that if more of us do that and do that in a way where we can support and elevate one another, that really great things for the team can happen. And so I honestly believe this is the best of both. It's getting to teach both components of an individual sport and a team sport, and an important part of what I do on a daily basis.
At what point in your career did you begin to think about coaching?
Well, early on, I had no intention of being a coach. Primarily, I was going to be an athletic trainer because I really enjoyed sport and science and thought that was where I wanted to go. And then I kind of gravitated toward teaching. My mom was an educator, and I thought that I would more of teach in a classroom setting, teach science, teach math. Fourth or fifth grade is really something I appreciated. And then when I was doing my student teaching, I had an opportunity to coach. I really thought, even when I started collegiately, that I'd probably do it for about 10 years, and then I would have a family and probably teach more in the classroom. And I never saw myself coaching as a career.
So there was no sort of master method to this or design?
No.
It happened organically?
Absolutely.
When you started to go to some of the larger meetings and you were beginning to coach, how many other women were doing what you were doing?
Not very many. You know, even to this day, our sport is definitely one where typically the women are more of the developmental coach, the age group coach, and as you progress in the sport, you know, you go into a more competitive group, and that tends to be run by a male. You know, so that has been an adjustment for me, and many times an adjustment for the athletes.
You must have made this observation that you were pretty much on your own doing this. How did it affect you?
It felt lonely at times. It still feels lonely at times, to be honest. There's a sense of pride, too, of doing something that a lot of people aren't doing and doing it well, particularly now, a sense of responsibility to talk about that and why aren't more women doing it and what are the advantages of having female leadership in our sport or in a team, particularly with female student athletes.
And what was the attitude of the men towards you in the early days?
Well, I think I've been blessed that I have had some strong men that have been supportive. And then I think I was exposed to colleagues that I had to be better than my male counterpart. I believe that's true for female coaches. I think a lot of it is the networking, but I'm still dismayed where if a female, particularly a head coach, does struggle or might get fired or whatever, that they don't really get a second chance. It's kind of a one and done, unfortunately. And I think that's something that we need to look at, as why will a male get fired and then be up for other positions, and when a female gets fired, it's like, well, what is she going to do next? Because obviously she's not going to coach. And I've read some really interesting things that, I mean, this is not just swimming. I've not just seen it in swimming and women's basketball. And I also think as women's sports have progressed in the United States, it is an okay profession for men to coach women. You know, in my mom's day or early collegiate athletics, women were coached by women and men were coached by men. I think if you look across the board, I don't know the statistics, more women's coaches have actually, the percentage of women coaches in all sports is decreasing because it's more of a viable option for men.
You have had some of your credentials or training techniques criticized over the years, and some of that criticism has come from men. Did you ever feel that there was a sexist element to that?
I don't think it was more sexist as much as it was just a theory outside of the box that wasn't really appreciated. It was just an extra reason to criticize it because yet I was a woman, and so it just led more value to why they could, I think, criticize it or not take it seriously.
We're going to hear now from Kathy Wickstrand. She is one of your longest and closest friends, a coaching partner as well. And you've known each other for almost 30 years?
Just our friendship's taken an interesting journey. And she was a swimmer herself and a collegiate coach as well. Without meeting Kathy, I would not have achieved the things that I've done. It took me a very long time in life to learn that asking for help is a sign of strength, not a sign of weakness. And I think it is because of some of my background and needing to be the oldest and needing to be the one that had the answers. And it's helped me achieve the things I wanted to do personally, professionally. I have her come in now and help me with team building and just developing young people. It's been an amazing relationship.
Tell us about your first meeting with Terry and how you got to know each other.
In the mid-80s, there were maybe five females who were swim coaches at the Division I level, and I was one of them, and Terry was one of them. Terry actually made a phone call to me, and she was really struggling with her team and with the performance of the team, and she reached out and asked for help.
What kind of help did she need?
Well, I think one of the things Terry is brilliant at is the technique of swimming, the competitive part of swimming. I think what she was struggling with was the group dynamic part of swimming. That's such a big part of it in my mind. And especially when you have a group of really talented women. My job as I started to work with her is for her to get back to herself, that was good enough, that if she coached the way that her own philosophy, that I believed that she would be successful. So in all the years that I've known Terry, I've seen her go from a woman who was scared to have her own voice to a woman that inspires hundreds of thousands of young women and other coaches across the world. She's not afraid to be different, and I love that.
Do you see her as a trailblazer, as a pioneer?
Well, I see her as all those things, and she really does not like when her close friends say that to her. She wants to be, many times she just wants to be a garden variety coach. You know, she doesn't want to be at the top of the heap and she doesn't want to be at the bottom of the heap. And yet, I don't know anybody who strives for excellence in every area of her life more than Terry does. So she doesn't want a lot of fanfare and a lot of bells and whistles. She just really wants to do her job quietly.
How would you sum Terry up as someone who has essentially rewritten the textbook?
I would sum her up, Terry is bold, she's strong. I love that she looks at this sport in a mind, body, soul perspective. Terry can be very critical. She'd be the first one to tell you that. She's not afraid to tell women what they're doing right and what they're doing wrong. She doesn't apologize for that.
Terry became the first woman to coach the U.S. women's swimming team. How did that affect her?
The first word that comes to me is pride. I was a swimmer. I was a coach. I got to go to the Olympics with Terry in Australia as a spectator. We went together to watch a couple of her student athletes. And to see her in 2012 be named the head coach, if you don't understand the swimming world, it's hard to even conceive what a big deal that is. Women were managers. Women weren't even assistant Olympic coaches. So it delights me, and she is a fitting person to fit that bill.
I'm curious to know your own Olympic journey as a coach. Was that something you ever expected to achieve?
Absolutely not. When I first was here at Cal, I had an assistant, and I remember us having a discussion, and he said, I want to be an Olympic coach. And I was like, really? I was like, man, I never even thought of that. And I had never thought of it. And I remember it led into 2004, and people were talking about I might have an opportunity to be on the staff, and there had never been a woman. I just couldn't even believe that. It never occurred to me that there had never been a female Olympic coach. And I think the magical thing about the Olympics, and I particularly experienced this leading into London when I was named the head coach, is I knew professionally what an honor that was and what an achievement it was. I have a colleague that calls it the O word. When you use the O word, it really, that just has an extra ring to it. And I wasn't really aware of that, I think, until almost halfway through being able to do this. So I was like, wow, this is a big deal.
So I get the sense almost you still don't quite believe it.
No, I don't quite believe it. I don't quite believe it. I don't think I'll believe it until this is all over and I'm sitting somewhere and I have perspective, you know? I've told this story before of like someone like Michael Phelps.
Can Phelps hang on? He's done everything else in the sport. Can he win the one event for the third time? Phelps holding Lochte, the greatest of all time, iconic figure, writes his way into the history books. The most remarkable Olympian in over 100 years.
For the rest of our life, my life, when every time there's an Olympics, Michael Phelps' name will be brought up. And I have such an unusual and amazing perspective of what Michael Phelps did or anyone does in Olympic Games. You know, I'll come home and I remember my brother after Athens was saying, wow, is it as pretty there as it looks on TV? And I was like, you know, I kind of said, well, it's not really. And then I remember seeing the closing ceremonies and the introduction of what's on TV. And I was like, wow, that's where I was. And they're really portraying it in a different way. So my experience of the Olympics is very different than what the general public sees when they watch on TV.
Well, Terry, stay with me. We'll continue this conversation. I'm keen very much to find out more about really what happened once you became an Olympic coach. You have continued to develop what is quite a unique coaching style, and also talk about the success, of course, which you had at the 2012 Olympic Games.
The BBC World Service.
Share the experience with the world. From the teams and the players.
I'm Lee James, and we'll be bringing you a daily roundup of all the World Cup results and reaction.
The cities and the fans.
Ben James here, and Brazil Today is the daily interactive show where we'll discuss the day's talking points.
To the news and the stories.
I'm James Menendez, and every day we'll bring you the people, the sights and the sounds of Brazil.
Throughout the month of the tournament, we'll be where the action is. In Brazil.
We'll bring you all the excitement surrounding one of the world's greatest sporting occasions, the decisive moments of the tournament, and the chance for you to have your say.
Share the experience with the world on the BBC.
The basketball coach Pat Riley once said that to have long-term success as a coach, you have to be obsessed in some way. Well, Terry McKeever shows all the signs of being obsessed, obsessed by the pursuit of excellence in swimming and of finding new and different ways to produce world-class athletes here at the University of California. I'm Peter Bowes, and for the managers on the BBC World Service, I've come poolside to meet McKeever. That's after the latest BBC News.
Ukraine's new president, Petro Poroshenko, has called for dialogue with separatists in the east of the country. After a swearing-in ceremony in Kiev, Mr. Poroshenko set out steps to end the country's crisis. The Russian ambassador to Ukraine, who attended the ceremony, called Mr. Poroshenko's peace plan promising. The Colombian government and negotiators from the FARC rebel group have agreed to set up a truth commission to investigate the deaths of at least 200,000 people in 5 decades of conflict. The announcement has been seen as a significant step towards peace. Militants who stormed an Iraqi university campus in the western city of Ramadi have released dozens of hostages after a gun battle with security forces. Militants took control of Anbar University in the early hours, killing 3 guards. The Nigerian army has raided distribution centres for some of the country's main newspapers. Nigeria's defence spokesman said this was part of a routine security operation. He denied reports that copies of newspapers had been confiscated. America's First Lady, Michelle Obama, has led tributes to the black writer and civil rights activist Maya Angelou, who died last week. Speaking at a memorial service, Mrs. Obama said that Maya Angelou's words had inspired and sustained her long journey to the White House. 11 crew members of a Malaysian-owned ship that was hijacked by Somali pirates have been freed after more than 3 years in captivity. The sailors were from South Asia and Iran. Armed men in the Democratic Republic of Congo have killed at least 27 people in the eastern province of South Kivu. Witnesses say at least 8 children and 14 women were among those killed overnight in the town of Mutarule. And in the tennis, Maria Sharapova of Russia has just won the French Open title in Paris. In a tightly fought match, she beat Romania's Simona Halep in 3 sets. BBC News.
I'm Peter Bowes, and welcome back to The Managers here on the BBC World Service. I'm on the campus of the University of California, just outside San Francisco, with the swimming coach, Terry McKeever. Now, Terry, over the years, you have been described in many ways as an innovator, as a trailblazer, as a pioneer. But I'm curious to learn more about your coaching techniques, because at the beginning, clearly, you were not a trailblazer. You weren't pioneering to start with. So how have your techniques evolved?
Well, I think it does go back to the background of, working out in a backyard pool and kind of thinking outside of the box and maximizing time. And I've always felt that sometimes in swimming, we're training to train instead of training to race. And I think that's the biggest aha I've had in my career is, like, are we really doing things that are allowing us, when we get up on the block, to race, that it's a performance? You know, it's a physical performance, it's an emotional performance, it's a mental performance, and we need to look at all of those things so that when that athlete gets up there, they feel they're physically, mentally, and emotionally ready for this performance.
So as you started your coaching journey, how soon did you begin to question what were the conventional training methods and develop your own system?
Honestly, I think I probably started questioning them as a collegiate athlete myself, because I had an unusual background, and then I went into a university myself into a more traditional coach, traditional program, and didn't perform any better. I trained better, longer sets, what I think sometimes people valued more, but then when I got up to perform, I wasn't performing any faster, and that really didn't make sense to me and made me start kind of questioning things. The other thing I remember as a collegiate athlete myself is I was in an environment where if we all swam a 200 butterfly and there was 4 of us, then we were all supposed to have the same race plan and race the same way, and that didn't make sense to me either, because I didn't think my strengths were the same strengths that my teammates had, so why would we all want to do it the same way? And I think out of frustration, it's like I'm putting more time, energy, and effort, it's still important to me, and I'm not performing any better. I don't understand why.
And one key aspect of training, simple aspect that you questioned relatively early on, was this idea of distance over quality, of getting as many laps in as possible versus doing a minimum amount of effort, I suppose, but other training methods as well. And that really went against the grain, didn't it, to start with?
Absolutely. It was more of like the more volume you could get in, the better it would be. And I think there's a place for volume, but there's also a place for quality. And I don't always mean quality is faster. I think quality is about quality technique, quality is about purposefulness, intention, relationship to your racing event. I like to use this example with the girls that if we were ice skaters and we had our long program was 4 minutes, I don't think an ice skater performs 10 times their 4 minute program and expects their 4 minute program to be better when they get to the competition. But what they do is they take pieces of that 4 minute program and they execute that at the highest level that they can. And then they start linking those pieces together to give different experiences. Because every race is not going to go exactly the way you want it to. There are elements of racing, and if I can put the athletes in those situations and they know that they can manage them and they develop their own problem solving, then when they're in the race, they're empowered to be faster, better. And it's them doing it. It's not a plan that a coach is given. It's a plan that they've developed for themselves by what they do every day in practice.
So we're going to go 200 swim, then 425s. The odd ones are SGS. The evens are something spunky. And you're going to take four exhales, rest in between. Then right here, what I forgot was 1 minute jumping out of the pool. That's dry land of your choice. And then three broken 100s, 75 kick drill swim, take three bobs, something 25 that's connected to your race, rest 15 seconds, and then we'll do the whole thing twice through. Okay? And we'll get out about 2:45 so that we have a little bit calmer time to get up to the Gold Gym, and Cara's meeting us right around 3 o'clock, and we'll go to 3:45. Sound good?
So you put a large part of the onus in terms of development on the athletes themselves. You can't tell them everything.
Absolutely, absolutely. That is huge, a cornerstone to what I believe is different. I think a lot of people think the difference is about the volume and quality. I believe the greatest difference is in those subtleties of asking the athletes to use their imagination, to connect with a race experience, to put themselves there emotionally, physically, mentally. I can't really monitor that. I can get a sense of that, especially when you work with someone, but really it's their responsibility. And I think then that when they get up and they have a peak performance, I hope they know that it was about them. It wasn't about a coach. It wasn't about a workout. It was about them and them problem solving. And that feeling, that empowerment, I think transcends that race, and that's what I'm passionate about.
And one interesting part of your training techniques is that some days you will actually avoid the pool completely.
Absolutely. I think initially I felt that, you know, being in even the weight room or being doing dance or having a spin class or taking a boxing class, I saw it as a diversion from what can be a very monotonous, boring sport. And I think where I've really evolved as a coach is being able to coach that if you're on a spin bike and you're getting really tired and the instructor is asking you to turn up the resistance, do you put your hand down there and really turn up the resistance, or do you fake it so that the coach and your teammates think you're turning up the resistance? Like checking in with that, you know, when you're tired and you get into your shoulders and your head kind of draws and you hunch forward, those same physical patterns show up in their stroke. Now, most of these women have swam and have a very high level of success before they get here. If we're going to look at making changes, I think it is much safer for them to talk about it on a spin bike than it is to talk about it in their stroke. You know, when we do dance, one of the most fascinating things for me is to watch when an athlete's learning a new skill. When they get frustrated, do they give up on themselves? Do they try to be disruptive and get their teammate giggling and off track? Do they stay after it? Do they practice it? Do they practice it from one time to the other? And, you know, that's when you can figure out who's willing to make that next step to be great. Who do you want on the end of your relay? Who's really going to reach their potential and who just says they want to reach their potential? And I think that those You know, those are things that we talk about after we do them. There are athletes that want to take their sport and help them transcend their sport, and there are athletes that just want to swim, you know. I don't think they even want to be mediocre.
They don't want to be, but maybe they are.
Or they don't want the responsibility to connect those dots. You know, all I can do is provide the opportunity. They have to be willing and engaged in the process of connecting and integrating and evaluating and modifying. That can't be something that Terry McKeever does. That has to be each individual athlete's journey. And you can come into our program and do these different things, and I think you will improve. But if you come in and you do these different things and you really get the essence of what and why we're doing something, I believe you can take that next personal step.
So this mind-body connection, understanding what's happening, is crucially central.
Yes.
Your left hip more toward the cement. Left hip toward the cement.
I think oftentimes the traditional model is coach has the information, athlete needs to do it. I want to have a model where I have information, the athlete has information, and we're partnering in that.
And then here. See the difference? Now you can feel it in your stomach, right?
Yeah.
Where, like, go like that. See? That's how you swim. That's how you want to go.
You know, it's not about me standing on deck giving information. You take the information, do something with it. It's me giving information. It's me asking, just like you're asking me questions to get at an essence of who I am. My job is to ask them good questions to get to the essence of what they're thinking.
Right? Yeah. You feel that? That right there, if you make that adjustment, golden.
I like this analogy of, you know, and they come with all different scripts playing about their technique, about their stroke, about their race strategy. My job is to maybe get another tape playing in there, or to add to that so that it sounds like it would make it more confusing, but I think what it can do is make it more clear and more simple when you get to the performance by making it messier every day at practice. You know, I think sometimes people think, oh, you just swim, and then when you get to the meet, you want to think about what you're doing. I think it's the other way around. I think every day you swim. In the weight room, you think. In the dance room, you connect the dots. And then when you get to the performance, you just perform. And a great performer doesn't think their way through it. They respond to the environment. I believe an ultimate performance is organic. A subpar performance is one that's orchestrated and calculated and sort of laid out prior to having it.
This is like 100 times I swim with Mike.
Yeah.
I was red.
No sunscreen?
Nope. I was outside for an hour.
What is the value of coaching as a team? Because essentially that's what you do. Yet swimming is by its very nature, ultimately, on race day, it's a very solitary experience.
I think the value in the team is to be surrounded by like minds, like intention, like focus. I mean, that's the thing I am most proud of what I've built right now, is an environment of young women that want the best for them, but they want the best for the people that are willing to pay the same price, so to speak. You know, to learn that if I help you improve, I'm going to improve. That my improvement doesn't have to be imparted by giving and exchanging and supporting another person. That I am going to feel more complete and more empowered if I am engaged in this process. We do a lot of partner coaching, you know, and you might be a breaststroker and I'd be a butterflyer, but we're gonna work on turns. But it's more conceptual of helping and supporting each other than it is of like the X's and O's. And I think that's what, when in this university setting, is supporting each other as athletes. It's supporting each other as young women trying to figure out who they are. It's supporting each other as students and the stresses that go along with that. So it's an important, done right. I think it's learning to respect differences in people and appreciate them.
not Facebook.
He texted
everyone.
We're not
back.
On
I don't think he replied
yet.
On Facebook. We're not on texting level yet. Clearly,
the respect is key, but what if they don't get on? What if they don't like each other? Can they still have that professional, if you like, respect?
I don't care if they don't like each other, because we're not here to like each other. We're not a sorority. We're a competition team. It's not a social endeavor. It's a achievement and endeavor. And when you're in the workplace, you're not going to like all your coworkers. But if you're working together as a team to build a new product and to exchange ideas and support each other and make the best widget, you might not like them, but you want to respect what each person brings to the table. I know they don't like each other. I know they don't like me every day, but I hope they respect me.
I find it difficult to believe that they couldn't not like you.
You haven't known me that long yet.
I was going to ask, do you adopt a different persona when you're coaching?
No, but I think sometimes that is what's confusing for young people. I think particularly women, whether you're older or younger, we want people to like us. That's in our DNA, you know? So when you have a coach that oftentimes has to have a hard conversation with you and be truthful and authentic with you, you're not going to like what I have to say. And what their job is to distinguish that Terry likes you, but she's coaching you right now. I'm a firm believer of asking each athlete what their goals are and coaching them to those goals. If a young woman says, I want to make the travel team, that's a different set of expectations than a young woman that walks into our program and says, I want to make an Olympic team or I want to be an Olympic medalist. My expectation of that young lady is going to be different than the one that is, you know, not of that level, but they still need to live up to that expectations and elevate and support the team environment.
In lane 5, the winner of gold in the 200-meter backstroke at the 2011 FINA World Championship, representing the United States of America, Missy Franklin.
We're going to hear from Missy Franklin, who was part of your Olympic team, and you coach her now here in Berkeley in California. And it is clear that she has been inspired by many of your techniques.
I was very blessed as a young swimmer. I was able to work with a lot of coaches on the national team who were also collegiate coaches. So I was able to work with Terry when I started kind of making my way through the national team with USA Swimming. And that was really my first glimpse of Terry and her coaching style and how she would coach the girls that she had with her on the trip. And there was always just something different about her and always something just unique, because their group never did the same thing that everyone else did. They always did something that was so special, and it was intriguing for me. I got to know her really well in London, and that was an amazing experience, and again this summer in Barcelona. And I knew there was just something special, but you really can't put your finger on it. And then once I got here and became a part of this team and became a swimmer under Terry, it was when I was finally able to realize how she's able to see so much more.
Help us try to understand what it is and what is so special about it. How has it affected you, and how has it made you a better swimmer?
In so many different ways. I think, like I was saying about the big picture, Terry just doesn't look at the pool and see eight lanes, 25 meters long. I mean, she sees so much about it, and just like with the way the water moves and our relationship with the water. And when we're watching each other swim, there's so much that she points out in each other's strokes that I would have never seen before. But as soon as she says it, I'm like, oh my gosh, you're right. Like, I can totally see that. And it's incredible how she teaches us to use our entire bodies to move while we swim.
And Terry's philosophy about mind over body, mm-hmm. How important is that?
I think that's absolutely huge. I think that in all sport, you can train as hard as you absolutely want to, but if you're not mentally prepared the moment behind the blocks or the moment before your big race, then none of that's going to mean anything. So I think it's building up that mental confidence as you build up your physical confidence, and knowing that when you get behind the blocks, that you are ready to race and that you've done everything you can do to be ready. Because in that moment, if you believe that you've done everything you can, then good things will always happen.
And when you were first introduced to the yoga and the hip-hop and all the other activities that take place outside of the pool, what did you think And again, how did that help you?
You know, honestly, I was just so excited to do something different. I think a lot of people look at swimming and honestly think it's probably the most boring sport in the world to stare at the black line for 2 hours and just go back and forth. And sometimes it definitely does get very repetitive. But that's one of the amazing things about Terry is she's able to find ways to make what we do fun and different every single day. And so Terry has a different coaching style than any coach. And so now I'm just learning new things and I have that awesome base to go off of, but now I'm able to change and do things a little bit differently based on what I'm learning from Terry.
So in recent years, you've had a tremendous amount of success. It hasn't always been like that. And when you first started here, you struggled quite a bit, didn't you? Can you describe that journey from those shaky early days to a much firmer position now? And I imagine where you're feeling much more confident about yourself.
I think a lot of that struggle was personal struggle of not being confident in who I was and trying to probably be the female version of the great coaches of the days. And like I said earlier, going to the clinic and seeing that and going, wow, I don't do that. I need to do that. That's what the good coaches do. And I kept struggling and I really got to the point, and Kathy had a lot to do with that, of really just helping me get to the point of recognizing I don't need to do that to be successful. There might be another way. And the most important aha of the whole experience for me has been to be the best Terry. And Kathy and I have sort of coined the phrase of nurture your nature, you know, and my nature is a certain way and my job is to nurture that and continue to show up and grow what feels right for me, because that's when I'm going to be most authentic in my communication. That's when I'm going to be most confident in the direction I feel that I'm leading young people.
And I mentioned the huge amount of success you have had. 2012 Olympics in London must have been the pinnacle of your career.
I think to walk through that journey and at the end of the day really know that because of, you know, leading women, yes, that you've spent every day with, but leading women primarily that you don't spend every day with and helping them become to a team, but giving them a voice in a new way. Some of my, not favorites, not the right word, but most meaningful experiences when I reflect on London are sitting in press conferences and hearing an Allison Smith or Missy Franklin at the time, or a Rebecca Soni, women that knew me but didn't spend every day with me, say, you know, this is the closest I've ever felt to the women I'm working with. Like, we're having fun, we're enjoying it, we feel strong. You could tell by the way they were acting, they felt empowered. And, you know, I've said that word a lot, but I think giving them a voice and a place to be scared, to be confident, and there's a lot of different ways to do that.
Was there a certain amount of persuasion involved to adopt your techniques for those women who weren't part of your team here? Being an Olympic coach, of course, you're working with new people.
Not so much from the technical part in the pool. The Olympic coach is more of a manager here. You know, I'm managing different people's programs. You don't want to change their training program. But I think what I was able to really affect was the group dynamic. You know, for 8 days, we're trying to beat each other so that we can be on the U.S. Olympic team. And then we take 2 days off, and all of a sudden, we're supposed to work together. You know, that's a really interesting, when you think about it, it's like, wait, I wanted to beat you, and now all of a sudden, I want to support this person. And so I think that's where I felt like, as an Olympic coach, I made the most difference. You know, from the training perspective, it's more of what is happening here at Cal and the women that I get to spend every day with.
Looking at 2012 again, were your aspirations achieved? I mean, did you set certain goals, and how did you feel at the end?
It's interesting because when I had been an assistant in 2004 and 2008, you know, I heard the leadership at the time talk about how many medals we needed to win and what would be better than what we had done before. And I think that's important, but I don't believe that that's the most that will take care of itself if you can create an environment where everyone feels their best, that they have a voice. And so I was very much disillusioned in 08 by my experience, and honestly never wanted to be the head coach. The greatest gig in the world is to be the assistant coach and have your little group of, you know, 3 to 5 and kind of do what the head coach and the leadership says. But I really felt like there's a better way to do this, and I would like to be able to have that opportunity. And at the end of the day, I think that I've opened up people in United States Swimming and other athletes and other coaches' eyes to that there's more than one way to be successful at the highest level. It's not for everybody. I fully know not everyone is motivated, or I would not be the right coach or the right team leader for everyone. But I think it's important, and what makes the United States so great is that we are open to different opportunities, and that's what I'm most proud of when I look at my interaction with the national team.
In that role, breaking through the glass ceiling, this phrase we often hear in relation to women achieving what was once considered to be unachievable, and perhaps you felt that about yourself. How important has that been to you?
I think it's been a blessing and a curse. I am very humbled and honored by that, and I also hope that there's a day when it isn't a story that, like it was in 2012, that I was the first female head coach. I hope that wouldn't be a story.
You said you were an introvert as a young girl. Is Terry McKeever, as an accomplished and recognized around the world coach of young girls now, is she still an introvert?
Absolutely. When the way Kathy, in our team environment, we've described introvert and extrovert is, introvert is someone that really gets their energy and refills their spirit by being alone and having time to think. And, you know, the best day in the world is a solo walk on the beach for me, or swimming in the ocean. I think that's the hardest part of what I do right now, is that there is a sense of needing to be more public and more vocal that is really not my nature. I think I always had a voice, I just didn't know how to articulate it. You know, as a young person, as a young coach, I had an opinion, I had a perspective, I had a voice, but I didn't know how to say it in a way that made me feel better. It always made me feel worse for speaking up. And that's what I've learned. For me to be true to me, I have to be able to express that voice, as uncomfortable as it may be at times.
Well, Terry McKeever, it has been a great pleasure to meet you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Managers was presented by me, Peter Bowes, and made in association with the Open University. It was produced for the BBC World Service by Richard McElroy. If you'd like to find out more about sports leadership and coaching, go to the Sports Managers programme page on the World Service website and follow the links to the Open University.